Welcome back, everyone. This is the Bless Your Boys podcast. I'm your host, Brandon Day. BlessYourBoys.com, of course, is your home for all things Detroit Tigers baseball on the SB Nation platform. And tonight, we have a special guest with us. We're going to talk with Max Boltman of The Athletic. Max has been writing about the Tigers for about a year, maybe a little bit less. We'll get to that, but he's produced a whole bunch of really, really great pieces, especially a couple we really loved recently, and we're excited to talk to him. Max, thanks very much for joining us on the Bless Your Boys podcast. How we doing this afternoon or this evening?
Oh, super good. How about you?
Oh, real well, man. Yep. Been waiting for the weather to get good and hopefully get out and do some mountain biking and running around and visiting some lakes here before too long. So,
where do you mountain bike?
Mountain biking is kind of a ludicrous term in Michigan, but there's trail systems kind of all through Oakland County. There's a good one up in St. Clair County where I live, at this kind of most random of locations. It's just this campground that these people run, and it has a whole bunch of kind of hills and forest in it, and they just kind of weaved a mountain bike trail all through that. So yeah, there's some places to go, but yeah, mountain biking kind of makes it out to sound better than it is.
No, I think it counts because the bike is called a mountain bike.
So it's a mountain bike. There's nothing I can do. Yep, there's nothing I can do. I don't know. Maybe it should be called a trail bike, but they failed in the initial naming process.
Or maybe they succeeded beyond their wildest dreams.
Yep, maybe they did. So you started with The Athletic. Is it like this year?
I think I went full time early November was when I officially started. I've been freelancing since I freelanced from August through early November, and then went full time. Around November 2nd, I want to say, was my first day.
Oh, right on. Yeah, I mean, we wanted to have you on just because you've really been impressed with the coverage. Not just yourself, but especially of late, some of the articles you've had up there, we've just been really big fans of over at Bless You Boys. So happy to talk to you. How did you kind of get into sports journalism? Was that something you wanted to do when you were a kid?
Yeah, well, first of all, thanks for saying that. Super nice of you.
Yeah, no problem.
But yeah, no, I kind of stumbled into it in college. I walked into the Michigan Daily newsroom, mostly like, well, what happened was I got like a copy of the Daily when I was the summer before my freshman year, and I just thought it was like the coolest thing in the world that students had been there writing about Trey Burke's shot against Kansas, which happened the day I got into Michigan.
Oh, yeah.
And so.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that's interesting.
Right. Yeah. So I thought it was really cool that, students had been there doing that. So I fired off a couple emails and just basically was doing it as much as anything. Well, one, I just thought that was cool. And for two, I was like, I need some friends when I get to school. Like, I don't know that many people who are going here. I had a couple of kids from high school and stuff. But so that was kind of the crux of it. I didn't go in and trying to be a journalist. I was just looking for some friends and trying to get, free passes to sporting events.
And, yep. Kind of find your way on the campus and stuff and kind of a community. Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, it spiraled, and I couldn't ever convince myself to quit as much as my bank account might have wanted me to at some times.
Yeah, for sure. It's not an easy gig to get into. I mean, were you a writer like in high school? Did you kind of grow up writing and enjoying writing, or?
I probably thought I was, but like looking back, like, no, not at all. But like, yeah, I think I always like thought of myself as like a good writer, but now like if I read one of my high school essays or poems, God forbid,
yeah,
I'd probably cringe.
Even when I go back and look at things I wrote like 3 weeks ago, sometimes I'm like, oh, why did I say that?
Same, absolutely the same. No, absolutely.
Yeah, it just seems like it never ends. Yeah, so let's kind of get into the Tigers here a little bit. You kind of titled like this whole kind of section of our conversation with the article about the quintessential Tigers losses a couple of days ago. And that we kind of had a bunch of them kind of all in a row there, five of them. Can you describe a quintessential Tigers loss to me?
I think what I was going for with it is just like there's all of these like problems that are like easily identifiable, like that went wrong and that went wrong and that went wrong, and with none of them like you're saying like, okay, well, and there's a solution. It's like, no, it's just like they're not good enough to win when they do those things, and there's not a clear way for them to stop doing those things by like replacement or different strategy or whatever except to just not do them. And
yeah,
that's like the rebuild quandary in as simple terms as I can put it.
Yep. And just kind of, yeah, I mean, it's a team that so far, like the starting pitching and the offense are kind of good enough to keep you in games. So they're not in danger of like some kind of 2003, 120 loss season or something like that. But then they just don't have the firepower to kind of pull out these close games, and they don't have the bullpen especially when Shane Green and Joe Jimenez aren't available, or you know, or you need three or four innings to kind of get to the house. So yeah, those
Yeah.
close games kind of are the ones where it really kind of stands out to you, do you think?
Yeah, and it's interesting too, because like it seemed like for at least like the first 5, 6 weeks of the season, like that was what everyone was pointing to as like the strength of this team was like pulling out close games. And I mean, I can see where that comes from, just because those are like all of the memories that people are going to have from the early part of the season, or like them pulling out, you know, a walk-off or a comeback or whatever. But like they also have had, you know, for the first part of the year, it was like they were either winning. They were scoring like all the runs and it was like a barn burner, or they were getting like no runs and they're losing like 2-1, 2-0, whatever it was. And now I think it's settled into this rhythm where like I mean, they're definitely going to have like those like 6-0 losses or whatever it was, 6-1 to the Indians the other day. But they're settling into a point where like the games are now like kind of more consistent and predictable in what you're getting from them.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, where you're seeing things like stable out into like these, like you just said, like 4 or 5 of them in a row that, you know, they had their different characteristics, but they were the same.
Yep, definitely. I mean, and they, you know, and they, it's almost, I mean, it can be more exciting because there's these close games where, like you said, they did pull some of them out, but that's the kind of thing that eventually almost always ends up flipping on a team unless there's just, you know, a monster bullpen or something. And it just we what it seems to me is we haven't seen, you know, we just don't see those extra games that, you know, an older, you know, a Tigers team 2 or 3 years ago could win by, you know, cranking three home runs and just kind of blowing somebody out here and there and putting that kind of a game in the mix, or a super dominant starting pitching, you know, outing where a guy goes, you know, Verlander or Fulmer goes 7, 8 innings. We just don't have those sort of extras to throw in the mix, it seems like.
Right, yeah, you don't get the guaranteed JD Martinez 8th or 9th inning home run that it used to be.
Yep, but they're still guaranteed out there, but yeah, we don't
They
have
are.
them.
Yeah, that just happened in Boston, yeah.
Yeah, I did have a couple friends from the Boston area kind of like, you know, questioning me before the season, like, you know, JD Martin, we know he's going to hit a lot of home runs, but you know, I mean, is he, we see a guy, you know, you can kind of depend on in the clutch, and I was just laughing. I was like, man, I don't know, for whatever reason, JD Martinez hits the best pitchers, you know, better than he hits anybody. So yeah, you guys are going to be in good shape, I think.
Interesting. Yeah. No, I'm sure they're loving him then.
Yep, no doubt. Yeah, but it'd be nice to have him and Mookie Betts. That's got to be fun. It's gonna be a good
They're so
feeling.
good, man. They're so good. Them and the Astros. I mean, and I've always like I'm a pitching nerd, so like I think like when I like look at the Indians, like they're the team that I'm always like, man, like to have that. But now the Astros are right there pitching wise, if not surpass them, and they have like crazy line like the AL is just it's just loaded.
Yeah, I mean, I really, you know, we talked all kind of off season. I'm sure you guys wrote about this plenty too, about, you know, the haves and have nots and the, you know, the tanking idea and all that. There's a lot of
Right.
teams in the middle, but those couple teams that stand out, yeah, the Yankees, you know, Red Sox, and obviously the Houston Astros. I don't know if anybody in the NL is quite running away with anything, but those three teams just look so much more stacked than anybody else.
Yep, I agree. No, I'm totally with you. No, we do like a power rankings thing every week, and I'm always like, all right, I gotta sprinkle some NL teams in here somewhere. So like, let's get the Braves in. For a while, the Diamondbacks were the easy one to go to,
Yeah.
but now they're like hitting it hard, so
Yeah, it was like 9 out of 10 games they lost or something.
something like
They
that, yeah.
hit a brick wall kind of there. Although
Yeah.
the Dodgers, you know, just don't seem to have the same kind of depth, you know, they have in years previously. And then, you know, you lose Corey Seager, the all-star caliber shortstop, and Kershaw's hurt, and yeah, it doesn't. It's you kind of start to wonder. You know, I assume that the Dodgers at some point will get it together and maybe make a deal for something that they need. But yeah, they don't look like they're going to be a juggernaut this year.
Right, like the Cubs, like they're like in like 4th place this morning, I think I saw when I woke up. Like that's
Yeah.
nuts. I mean, I know their run differential is insane, and they're like 4 games back, but still, I don't know.
Yeah. Meanwhile, the Tigers, right now at least, are dead on target to finish with 69 wins, which is where I predicted them.
Wow.
Yeah. So yeah, it's, you know, it's just kind of going to be the way it goes. You know, looking at the first, you know, 48 games or whatever it is, I mean, is there anything that, you know, in terms of individual players' performances that has really stood out to you or surprised you so far?
Well, for a while, I was saying that, you know, I mean, the answer is probably Matt Boyd, but that obviously now you wonder about the oblique and if that's going to cause him any further problems. It didn't seem like he thought so. I tried to ask him, like, is it like a, because he was saying like he wanted to stay in the game or whatever, but he, you know, that's going to be like the thing to watch now because he was evolving into kind of the most promising thing about the season early on. I mean, him and Liriano and with the potential trade value implications for Liriano.
Yeah.
Offensive side, I mean, it's interesting how like Jacoby Jones and Leonis Martin both are now kind of having the same deal where it's like their defense is so good, you got to keep them in, and like, what are you worried about anyway? It's a rebuilding year, but like,
Yeah.
they're both kind of on this trajectory where they can either be like the most exciting player in a given game, or the most like, what's going on here?
Yeah.
And Martin's got like what, like one hit since coming back from the DL now.
Yep, it's been pretty sparse, and I think Jacoby Jones still has one walk on the
Oh
season.
my gosh, yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting with Jacoby Jones. I mean, Leonis Martin, I don't know where that start came from, because that he looked like the player, that people kind of thought he might be when Texas finally, acquired him back in, like, I don't know, like 2012 or something like that.
Yeah.
So I didn't know what to make of that, but Jacoby Jones is just going to be such a volatile player until he can, if he can figure out a way to draw the kind of walk rates he did in the minor leagues, because you just see him, when he's not getting hits, then his extra value in running the bases, is completely wiped out, and it's like his whole profile just goes to hell. And then, a couple days later, he'll have a three hit game, and all of a sudden, his average is up 50 points, and it looks like, oh, he's doing pretty well again. And it's just, early season numbers are funny that way, but especially with a guy who doesn't have the stability of a kind of a solid on base percentage to back it up. It's just kind of a roller coaster with him so far.
Right, and it's interesting. Is his contact rate? When I wrote about him a few weeks ago, and his contact rate was like up like meaningfully from last year. And I thought that was a big part of kind of his game because he's so fast that like he does need to be he needs to like lower the strikeouts is a big thing. And he can be like a 20% strikeout guy and probably be fine if he walks a little more. But also like if his contact rate is solid, like he's got the wheels to leg out some infield singles there and like make some stuff happen. But I don't know if that's because I don't know if the contact rate has stayed high through this more recent dip. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah, I don't think it actually doesn't look like it's that bad. It's his swinging strike rate, I know, has kind of climbed back up to where, or pretty close to where it was last season. But he's still, I mean, his strikeout rate is still, in the high 20s. And yeah, I mean, it's doable because the defensive profile and the base running is so good. But yeah, he's got to spray the ball around and play and maximize, everything he can get out of that. It'd be nice if he was hitting for a little more home run power. He definitely has it. We just haven't seen him kind of square up enough balls in the air, I guess, perhaps. But he's kind of looked
Yeah.
like Cameron Maybin did a couple years ago to me, where he's shortened up and is kind of just trying to put the ball in play. But
Yeah, that was the year that, like everything was falling for Maven, wasn't that? Like everything he was putting in play.
yep, that was a crazy season, because when he was on, base a lot, I mean, he's just, a firecracker out there in the same way that, Rajai Davis was. So
Oh yeah.
yeah.
It's gotta drive Gardenhire nuts. Like with I mean Jacoby Jones, like the give and take that he has of like the base running where he'll blow through a stop sign and score a massive run, and then he'll also try to steal a base and get thrown out, and yeah, what do you do?
Yep. I mean, you kind of, yeah, we talked about this kind of all through the Ausmus years, kind of behind the scenes at Bless Your Boys, about how Brad Ausmus every season would kind of come out with this mantra, like, we're going to run the bases aggressively now. We're going to get rid of, kind of this station to station approach we had last year and get after it. And they would do it for, 3 or 4 weeks, but it seemed like once enough guys had kind of gotten thrown out on the bases, they all kind of got scared. And when you have a team, with no expectations, which is, in a way, a nice feeling probably for some of the guys there. I guess you can kind of push it more, and maybe that's what it takes, is to just keep running the bases aggressively and kind of learning your limits that way, rather than kind of pulling back and like, oh, I don't want to get thrown out. So it'll be interesting to see if Gardenhire's approach kind of sustains throughout the year here.
Absolutely. On a note, I mean, the original question I think was about like kind of early season like surprises or whatever. I don't know if this is a surprise, but like J.Ryan Candelario is very, very impressive so far. I mean, I know that he coming into the year was good, but like that is something to kind of get back to where I think you were trying to take it. Like that is something that I think Tigers fans can be actually very, very pleased with is how he is performing and how he looks like he's shaping up to be a guy for the next few years.
Yeah. I mean, he really does look like a supremely professional hitter for his age. Yeah. And he flashed. I think that, the thing that really has surprised us is, just the power, the raw power, hitting 440 foot bombs. Like, it seemed like everybody, when he was in the Cubs organization, expected him to be a guy who would get on base for you and probably hit for good average and some power. But yeah, he may be flashing more power potential than we thought, which is pretty exciting.
Yeah, and I wonder, I've always wondered like how much of this is like when you're like a really good hitter, like can't you just like doesn't that just help you hit for power? Like because the thing that's the thing that people have always said about like Ichiro or whatever, like he could hit more home runs if he wanted to. So
Yeah.
like if when you're in, I'm not saying Candelaria is an Ichiro level hitter, but like when you're in command and in control of yourself at the plate, when you have the kind of discipline, that seems like something that you can maybe overachieve with power. I could be totally off base saying that. I'm not like a hitting coach, but that's
Yeah,
just kind of my very amateur observation.
it does. It does make sense though. Like the more balls you barrel up, and the better eye you have for not swinging at pitches that are going to be tough to reach or square up. Yeah, you'd think it would translate. And it seems like we've seen a lot more young players come up out of the minor leagues and hit for way more power than people maybe expected early on. And obviously, the ball might be playing a role in that as well. There was that an interesting study that MLB kind of put together with some independent researchers today that seemed to confirm that the ball definitely has less drag and is carrying farther, but still came up with basically no reason why that was. So yeah, that was kind of odd.
No, absolutely.
I'm sure
Absolutely.
Justin Verlander feels vindicated out there somewhere.
Yeah, somewhere
Just
he is out there.
doesn't Justin Verlander always feel vindicated though,
I
wherever
think
he's
he
at?
does. He makes sure that he does, yeah.
Yeah, he's vindicated in life, I think. Yeah, everything's going well for him. Yeah, the other one I guess we should touch on is Joe Jimenez, who a lot of us had pretty optimistic feelings about coming into last season. And we were definitely, me and Rob, our site editor, a couple of us were among the louder voices for, hey, they called Joe Jimenez up. This bullpen sucks. And obviously he struggled all year, but have you talked to him at all about kind of, the change in approach or, the work he put in over the offseason to kind of put up, the kind of early season numbers he's putting up?
Yes, and it would have been in spring training, so I'm gonna have to like kind of think back a little bit. But well, the thing that I can say pretty confidently is that he went down in Lakeland. He worked with Fulmer a fair bit. I think they were both in Lakeland together for like a prolonged amount of time. And Jimenez was kind of able to pick Fulmer's brain about some things. And I don't know if it was, I want to say there was something with the slider that they worked on together, but I think just in general, like pro habits kind of stuff and like approach mind, because Fulmer's so mentally tough, like. I mean, and I say that kind of just based on like my interactions with him, but like he is a relatively like level-headed dude. I mean, he's still passionate, obviously, but like he's able to walk away from a game and give really honest assessments of where things, happened. And I think for a pitcher, that's got to be huge to just be able to like kind of in like a you still care, but like get detached enough that you can give yourself like honest self-eval.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that like when you're then working with a young player, like what that must translate, I don't know. I mean, this is a little speculative, but I know that they were there together for a while, and I think Jimenez probably must have taken some of that from Fulmer, and he's also just I mean, like you said, he was so talented coming through the minors. Like it's entirely possible that this was just going to take him a little while to get to what he's doing.
Yeah, just to
But
maybe deal with the expectations that he had for himself, and yeah.
for sure, yeah. And so yeah, I think that's probably a big part of it, but yeah, no, I'll have to go look up and find some of those quotes, and maybe I'll like DM them to you or something. But I'm pretty sure they worked together in Lakeland because
Yeah,
we talked about that in the spring.
and I do. I mean, I vaguely remember reading that. And there was also, like the Bazio influence that, before, the team even got together with him, he was calling and texting everyone with ideas. And it seems like, not just Fulmer and Jimenez, but also Boyd and Norris as well. Like everybody kind of was working hard on kind of getting on top of the slider more and taking a little bit of speed off of it and getting more depth. And we've kind of seen that, across the board, in throughout the whole Tigers pitching staff. And it's kind of seemed like one of the keys. Like the Tigers are, as far as, team strikeout rate, are not good, but their better pitchers have definitely kind of shown an uptick in the effectiveness of their slider. And that seems pretty attributable to Bazio, as far as I can tell so far. Although it's always easy to, put everything on Chris Bazio and want him to be like the Yoda character behind the scenes, just because of the guy he is. But have you talked to Chris Bazio at all?
Not a whole lot. We talked at Tiger Fest, and then I think he's only talked maybe one time since the season started, and that must have been a day I wasn't at the park. But the Tiger Town talk or Tiger Fest, that day he was really good, and so I'll have to try to circle back with him soon. But he hasn't talked as much since the season started. It hasn't been kind of as and part of that obviously he was away from the team for a couple of days.
Yeah.
So I mean I'll have to see if he's going to talk again anytime soon. But yeah, that was something that like you said, he's calling everybody early on, and I think a lot of the pitchers, a few of the pitchers at the very least. I mean, Matt Boyd would probably be the poster child for sort of that sort of thing.
Yeah, for taking the approach of like, okay, I'm gonna get on the mound and chuck it. I'm gonna try to vary my delivery times and mess with people a little bit more. It seems like of all the pitchers, yeah, Matt Boyd is the one who's kind of taken that part of Bosio's approach to heart the most so far.
Right, and even like taking a little bit off of it in some guys' cases, you're not throwing the full velo that you can because you're working on, like you said, varying speeds. I think that's really interesting. I think like that timing thing. Someone came up the other day about Mario wrote something, I think, about this hesitation that Boyd added into his delivery. I think that's really interesting
Yeah.
as just a timing effect.
Yeah, and obviously not like a brand new thing, but it's a cool thing to see emphasized because hitters are squaring up so many balls these days. It's such an all or nothing approach that yeah, messing with people's timing seems, especially in like a key spot. Like if you did it all the time, I guess hitters would just kind of get used to you. But once you've got a guy in a two strike count or you need to make a big pitch, having that little trick in the back pocket seems like it might be useful. I remember Joe Jimenez kind of picking up from Francisco Rodriguez last year, the idea of mixing in a quick pitch occasionally, especially if it looks like a hitter is kind of thinking it through after taking a strike or something like that, to just kind of like get on the mound and just unload on it, right away, just whip a fastball by him. And I saw him do that, a couple of times last year when he was at his best. So yeah, it seems like kind of an ongoing practice. The whole, I mean, you're a pitching nerd, I am as well. The whole subject of pitching has gotten really interesting in the past couple of years with all the additional data we have and watching all these pitchers kind of try to deal with the rising home run rates. We've seen guys like Jordan Zimmermann and Anibal Sanchez suddenly become home run machines with kind of a ineffective fastball, whereas other guys have succeeded. Is there anything that you're kind of thinking about in those regards these days? I mean, the spin rate stuff has been particularly interesting. I know, Trevor Bauer obviously brought that to the fore, as Trevor Bauer will do recently.
Yeah, no, I mean, that was definitely like a very interesting whole topic. Like you're talking about like the pine tar experiment kind of thing.
Yeah, he was kind of, subtly accusing his, I believe, his former college roommate, yeah, Gerrit Cole especially, but really he kind of called out the whole Astros team, like, hey, what's going on over there with the pine tar, basically.
Yeah, no, oh my gosh, did you see the thing? I think Mizell wrote it for the Cleveland site today. He kind of opened up about him and Cole and their whole rivalry and all that stuff.
Oh no, I haven't seen that yet. I'll have to check
You'll
this
have to
out.
talk. Yeah, you'll have to check that out. I didn't. I'm not quite done with it. I started it, but as I'm sure you've known from reading some of our stuff on our site, it's not always the quickest read, but it's always very very thorough. So I'm gonna have to circle back to that and finish it. But yeah, there was a couple quotes in there that I think are very very Trevor Bauer.
Yeah, I mean, there was the, what was it, the BD 9/11 that he carved in the mound the other day, and I mean, he's just a magnet for controversy. He seems to love it at this point, so.
Yeah, no. But to answer your question though, the big thing. I mean, I love the opener. Like as just an experiment to see how this thing goes. Like bullpen management to me is such a fun like lab right now. Like people are trying so many different things, and it's a copycat deal, of course, too. But like, I do love when a team will try something, and you're like, "What the heck?" And then it's like, "Oh, I can see this after one or two times through."
Yeah, and it does get, I mean, it can really turn into, like you said, the kind of copycat thing. But you also wonder, people are starting to freak out, especially about like the opener. I've seen a few pieces already about how, the changing bullpen usage is really going to destroy, relievers' value in arbitration, and it's going to hurt starters' value by them not, necessarily pitching their normal kind of routine games and looking for wins and losses or quality starts and that kind of thing. But you also have to wonder, like, these are experiments, and if Sergio Romo went out there and just got absolutely wrecked by Mike Trout and Justin Upton, is anyone going to be, so up in arms about the potential labor and salary issues? It's these are all kind of experiments, and it definitely is an interesting time as far as that goes.
But that's part of the thing to me that makes it so interesting is it does have these far-reaching expect effects, and it's like I remember like when I was like in high school and college, and it's like starter, starter, starter. That's what you base your whole. But I mean, especially the Tigers were basing their whole team around. But now, like, it does seem like relievers are becoming a little more of a commodity, and there's exceptions certainly this year. I mean, I don't even know how much if this year, this past offseason in terms of free agency is going to become the norm or what, but. But I think you are going to see shifts in values in some way, like whether it's relievers and just being kind of more valued and more understood for what they can do. Like if you're talking about kind of the Gabe Kapler at the beginning of the year model, or if you're going to see sort of a swing back and the guys who the starters who you can rely on to go six or seven reliably or eight, are just going to see that much more valuable. To me, that's part of what makes this bullpen stuff interesting is the impacts that it has on contracts and it has on what the young up and coming pitchers in the sport, like how they see themselves projecting, you know?
How pitchers kind of define, what kind of role they expect to have, or whether or not they can, maybe they can adapt to having less of a strict role and kind of, being a little bit more flexible in that way. Yeah, it's, I don't know, it's interesting because I mean, it definitely is going to have these effects. It's just a question of whether or not things will sort of rebalance themselves. But it does seem like, I don't know, I've written about this a few times, but the MLBPA really didn't seem to do very well in the last collective bargaining agreement, to put it kind of mildly, probably.
Sure.
And I mean, and this just kind of seems like another issue that's going to play into that, where, at some point they're going to have to take a stand as far as, negotiating some kind of terms, or at least being able to affect the arbitration process a little bit more, because, teams are doing a much better job, from their perspective, obviously, of gaming the system and getting, getting an extra year, sometimes even an extra 2 years out of their young players. And so guys are finding themselves, basically playing their entire career under team control, or at least through their prime. So yeah, it's going to be, kind of interesting to see if these things play out, differently, and whether or not the union can kind of get its act together the next time and get something installed to kind of bolster some of the salaries, or at least, make a little bit better attempt at getting parity as far as, what relievers and some of these guys are able to earn.
It's interesting too, right? Because it's like it's this thing that's been become the status quo where the fans are like on board with these like labor practices that are not at all to the benefit of the athletes that they're like rooting for because their loyalty is to the team. I understand that, but it is I think that is like a component here that like if fan support continues to be so behind like those like labor practices and the way that's getting worked out, like teams have less incentive to give because their fans are all for it. You know what I mean?
And they're going to have to be kind of forced to come to the table on some of those things, which is why, it seems like a lot of people are kind of expecting a real kind of showdown the next time this goes to a collective bargaining agreement, which fortunately is still several years away, so we don't have to worry about it right away. But it does kind of feel like there's a storm brewing out there.
No, I mean, I'm sure they'd love to get to the negotiating table as quick as possible with as many things as have come up, recently, especially with the gambling stuff. Like, I'm sure that's going to be a massive. I mean, they might even need to work that out before the next CBA. They're going to need to work that out before the next CBA.
Yeah, because I mean, it's just hard to kind of, unpack that at all yet, because the Supreme Court ruled that sports betting, the ban on sports betting would be lifted, but we don't really know what shape it's going to take as far as, what companies are going to be involved in being able to, handle the gambling action and who, the licensing of all that. But then there's just all the implications for, the league and the possibilities for corruption. It's like there's seems like there's going to be an awful lot that the league has to do to, protect the sport fundamentally, as far as keeping, better tabs, I guess, on officials, from the replay guy to the umpires on the field to the players. There's kind of a lot of moving parts there. And then you've also got on the other side that it's probably going to, I would assume it's probably going to be really good for the game as far as its exposure. I don't know for sure if that's true, but it definitely seems to me that, the more invested people are, the more, there's going to be read and written about, the odds each day and, how players are doing and all those sorts of things. And it should draw more coverage to the game, I would think, as well.
Yeah, I mean it'll fundamentally change the way that people experience these games. Like, I mean with like fantasy baseball, right? Like very low level form of sort of this like way of viewing baseball. But like when I watch a baseball game, or at least like when I was in college or whatever, when I watch a baseball game, you watch and you're rooting for like individual play, like almost like okay, so I've got this pitcher, the starting pitcher, and I've got one player in the other team's lineup. So I want my guy to hit a home run off my pitcher and then everyone else to strike out, right? Like you're going to start to see people watching games like that in a similar like prop bet based way.
Demanding these very specific outcomes, or rooting
Exactly.
for them.
Yeah.
Yeah, that it is going to be strange. And you know, we're already at a place where people tell each other to just shut the hell up, you know, about their fantasy
Yes.
team. And so, you know, it just seems like that, you know, there might be a split between people who gamble and people who don't, as far as, you know, who reads what and what coverage appeals to which, you know, which side of the fan base. But yeah, that is going to be an interesting thing to watch. I've only bet on baseball like a couple times. You know, like I tried it on Bovada just to kind of see like, oh, how does this work and stuff. And you know, made a few bets in 2016 before the season, and one of them was that Justin Verlander would win the Cy Young, and I had like 40-1
Oh, is
odds
that the
on this or
Porcello
something.
year?
Yeah, and just got, you know, and nobody apart from perhaps Kate Upton was more annoyed than I was when Rick Porcello got locked out of that. But you know, yeah, I mean, I can just imagine if everybody was doing this regularly, like what the outcry, you know, over something like that would be. And it seems like it's also going to lead to maybe the need for things to be codified even more. You know, like there's any kind of loophole in the game, or you know, a game ending on a strike three call where the ball was actually outside is just going to, you know, send people into Apple. What is it? Just, you know, people are just going to lose their minds on
Yeah.
everywhere, you know, in general, just because, you know, we could get this right and you're not, and it's costing me money. And yeah, it's going to be really weird to see how all those pressures sort of start to affect the game.
The awards one did not even cross my mind, but you're right. Like, that's going to be a thing that, like, I mean, I would certainly love to sit here and say that, you know, the media is an always correct entity or whatever, but we
Yep.
know it's not the case. So it's like, but yeah, that's right. Like, people are totally going to accuse the media of taking bribes on award stuff. And wow, that hadn't even crossed my mind.
I mean, it really just is it's just a complete Pandora's box of maybe, you know, some good things, but man, there's just going to be so many issues, it seems like, you know. And it's interesting to see the league trying to kind of position itself to get a cut, because, you know, they're going to have costs, you know, incurred by, you know, having to kind of, you know, provide a lot more oversight, I would imagine. So yeah, watching them kind of work that way. And then I can't remember who it was. Maybe it was, it must have been Katie Strang. Yep. Is it managing editor of Athletic
Yeah.
Detroit?
Yep.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, she was talking about how, you know, Nick Castellanos, who's the Tigers player rep, was already texting with Justin Verlander about the implications of this. Justin Verlander's reaching out to big fancy people that Justin Verlander hangs out with. So yeah, it's going to be, you just kind of imagine there's, you know, a real storm going on behind the scenes of people trying to figure out what this is going to mean.
Yeah, no, I that's just so interesting. Cy Young, I mean, that's a media voted thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not a voter, but yeah, that
Yeah.
is interesting. So you got cost money because some newspaper writers kept Verlander off their ballot entirely, right? That was the deal.
Yeah, didn't even rank him like fourth or fifth. Yeah, they didn't have him on there entirely. Just weren't paying attention, I guess, the last month of the season or something. I don't know. So yeah,
Interesting.
but there might have been, you know, might have been 100,000 people like me all screaming out in the wilderness.
Well, and obviously at the time, like, you know, that's the sort of thing that goes because the bets are like so isolated to, well, supposedly isolated to Vegas, but that's interesting. I hadn't even thought of that.
Yep, there's gonna be weird times ahead as far as covering how all that goes. You know, and what still doesn't get discussed at all, of course, is minor league player salaries and ticket prices. You know,
Yes.
you see these amazing arguments between fans and stuff, you know, on social media, and it almost never comes back to, you know, the fans are, you know, are getting screwed by the owners. And you know, if the owners are spending on their team and the team is winning, it seems like no one cares, you know, about that side of it at all. And no one really thinks about, you know, the minor leaguers, unfortunately.
Yeah,
So
no, absolutely. That's very true.
it's just, you know, it's just one of those things again where there's all these people involved and you know, potentially, you know, affected severely by, you know, decisions that are made, but all the focus continues to stick on, you know, the millionaires and the billionaires fighting, kind of fighting it out. It's sometimes hard to have sympathy there.
I know it's interesting. Like, what is it going to take for the minor league baseball players to get a fair wage there? Like, I know that those clubs aren't always earning a ton of revenue, but
Yeah.
like they're taking every bit. Like, I mean, they're doing a ton of work for this too, and it's not always going to pay off for all of them. But I don't know. It's you read the Shane Green article I did. Like, the stuff that some of those guys have to do are
Oh yeah.
absurd.
Oh, I'm glad you brought that up, because that was a great article. Like, you know, I remember profiling him a couple years ago and trying to piece together his whole history, and it was very, very spotty. You know, it's like he had Tommy John surgery and then. And didn't and no one really thought he was going to be a pitcher, and you know, then that, you know, then next thing you know, he is a pitcher, and then there's kind of nothing about him until, you know, he broke in with the Yankees. He was really open with you about that. Have you kind of found Shane Green to kind of be like a pretty open, straight shooter type character? Because he really did kind of go deep into his history with you.
Yeah, it's interesting because you're like, you're not the first person. First of all, thank you for saying that. But like, he did. He was really open. And I got the sense of something he wanted to talk about was like that whole journey, just because I think he, now that he is at this point where he's in a pretty good place, I think he like wants other people who are in maybe kind of tumultuous sides of the minors to be able to like look to that and have someone, because so many of the guys that you look up to, I think when you're coming up really in any industry, are the guys who it seems like they were just so good that like it was gonna happen for them.
Yeah.
And I think in his mind he wants, maybe he doesn't want to be like a poster child, because I don't know if that's necessarily his personality, but I think he wants to be like an example of like, hey, just if you are worried because like it's not happening, or you're just unable for 3 years, or you're hitting whatever this is, or you're toiling in the summers feeling like you're not going to make it. I think he would like for kids like that to not be discouraged and quit, and to see like, if you still want to do this, like it's on the table for you. And that to me was why he wanted to be that open. Cause you're right. Like, you're not the first person who said like, he's not, that's not necessarily, I don't even think his nature, when you like see him in kind of the interviews on TV and stuff, but he was in that interview.
Yeah. Yeah. He can be a little bit more, you know, kind of, you know, cool customer, sort of taciturn with interviewers and stuff. But yeah, it almost felt like he really wanted maybe that's the perfect way of putting it, is that he's reached a good place and it was sort of like time to kind of look back down, you know, the mountain at the journey to get there. And it was an arduous journey. Did he talk at all about like the recovery from Tommy John surgery? Because I think people think, you know, there's all this help for you, or, you know, that, you know, there's people telling you what to do. But basically, you know, you get taken in, you get your arm cut open, and then they give you, you know, some kind of 2-page rehab sheet or something. And then it's kind of on you to do it. And he was what, like a 19-year-old junior college player who'd never really, you know, top 90 miles per hour and wasn't really a prospect at all at that point. And it's kind of incredible to push through at that point when there's really nothing being promised to you as far as like being drafted or, you know, scholarships.
Right. And he talked a ton about it. And I actually talked at length with his rehab partner at the time. So his college roommate and him both got Tommy John within 2 months of each other.
Oh, wow.
That's weird. I could have probably done a whole story on just this like side of it.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, so they both had it within 2 months of each other. They moved back home, and then they ended up enrolling at Daytona Beach Community College. And so they kind of do their rehab while they're a part of this like developmental team. And that's important because it allows them to use these facilities and like have like a weight room and have like, cause like you said, like you're kind of taking baby steps and then building up. And I want to say, I might have this slightly wrong, so I don't have it in front of me, but I want to say that Shane got his first, and so he was hitting every milestone like in advance of his roommate Matt Collins. And I want to say that like Matt said something about how Shane will go through these things, and I imagine there's a lot of things in this process where you're like, this is normal, you know? And when Matt would have those questions, he would go, hey, Shane, did you have this? And Shane would be like, yeah, yeah. But Shane didn't have that from Matt because Matt was behind him in the process. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and so no team trainers necessarily. I mean, maybe he had a little bit of help, but yeah, not like, you know, you would think in the minor leagues or you know, a top prospect has got like the whole organization behind him. You know, there's nothing like that.
Right, and so it's like, you know, they're doing this thing and they're going for it. They're basically sharing an apartment together, and they're like, hey, we should go run. Like, okay, it's midnight. Yeah, no, we got to do it. Okay, and so like one of them gets down, and the other's like, we gotta run today, or we gotta, you know, throw today, or whatever it is. But yeah, I mean, you're probably not throwing too much, but I guess. But yeah, I mean, it is interesting because this very much sounds like it was an experience that kind of nobody outside of those two people, at least for their kind of personal journeys with that, can understand as well. So I found that to be one of the parts of the stories that I wanted to explore more, and just, you know, it was 3,700 words. It would have been tough to go too much deeper
and
have people keep reading.
It was great though. That is another thing I really do appreciate about The Athletic is the long form pieces. We just, at Bless Your Boys, we don't really get the opportunity to do that kind of thing. It's sort of not really our niche. So when someone can really go super deep and get, a lot of good quotes into it, yeah, I'm all about it. And yeah, that was an excellent piece. Loved it.
Thanks, man. Well, that really means a lot. I was nervous about, how it was gonna come out, because it's the you don't want to mess up somebody's life story, like get something wrong in their life story, or as you tell them this whole like, this is we're covering, probably 10, 11 years of this guy's life. And the whole time you're writing it, you're like, oh man, like how do I characterize this? You know what I mean?
And then the next time
So
you see him, you're like, hey.
I haven't seen him since. I haven't. I was in. He. I never saw him at all when I was in Minneapolis. Like he was always out in the field when I was in the clubhouse, and I don't know if he was eating dinner or whatever post game. So I actually have not seen him since. I have no idea.
Oh yeah. Yeah, I mean, I can imagine it being a little nerve-wracking, but it'll be cool to I'd be interested to see how he felt about how it turned out, 'cause yeah, I thought it was pretty great. And it just gives you the flavor of what goes on as far as, it's almost like being in the military, when you're a minor league player and you're just kind of, you have no money for the most part. Maybe the top guys, still have their bonus money from, the draft and whatever, but I mean, you're out there, eating fast food and, traveling on buses, with guys that you just met, and you're all, the same age and trying to do this thing. But, a team can really mess with you. And it really struck me when he talked about kind of coming up with the Yankees in 2014 and how, they kind of, okay, you're going to start, but now we're the, for, maybe not, we're going to move you back to a relief role. And then we're going to switch that again. And then you got called up, but you blew up one time. And so you get sent back down. And just that feeling of being on the crux and not knowing what your role is going to be, and then finally just breaking through and getting called up because there was a need, but it is just interesting to think about how many guys out there are in that position right now. I can't kind of get over my feelings about this Victor Reyes situation, because I just feel like that he's got to be, I mean, this is a player who probably should be in double A, not even at triple A, and he's got to sit there day after day with Miguel Cabrera and all these kind of well-known players around him and can't really contribute and is just sort of in this bizarre limbo. And I've just been feeling for that cat, because you just see him come to the plate and he hasn't swung a bat in anger for, 2 weeks or something like that. And it's like, oh, here, come on in and face like Andrew Miller or something,
Yeah, and usually when that happens, it's because he the game is close enough for him to have pinch run previously, and so by that point you're thinking like we're talking ninth, 10th inning, high, like you said, high leverage. You may be facing the other team's closer. Yeah, you're right, because that is how he's gotten most of his playing time, is pinch hitting for Victor Martinez,
I didn't even, and
or
actually, I
pinch
hadn't
running,
thought
pinch
about it.
running.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about it that way either, though. Yeah, it's been a lot of late innings in tight spots, kind of pinch hit appearances for, yeah, a player who really, was succeeding okay at double A last year, but didn't really get a full season in. And you just kind of wonder, like if why something can't be worked out here, because, it just feels like it's really, kind of bad for his development. And, the Diamondbacks aren't going to get him back, because the Tigers can obviously keep him on the roster all year and, not suffer any consequences for him. So it's a weird impasse right now.
It is. It's very bizarre, and I don't know. Like, when do you think it's gonna be like a settled thing? Because I have like no time frame for like.
I really
I
don't
haven't
either.
like a lot of. I think Evan Woodbury from M Life, who's really good. I think he wrote something about how like a good portion of the Rule 5 picks have already been returned to their clubs.
Yeah, and then they usually don't work out. A lot of us wanted Nick Birdie, who was a really hard throwing reliever who the Tigers could have. I can't remember who took him. Maybe it was the Phillies,
He's
but
hurt, right?
yeah, he had Tommy John, and so he's going to be out all year. So you could kind of stash him on the 60-day disabled list all year long, and kind of still have the spot. So yeah, it was just, I mean, they must really like Victor Reyes, and whatever my personal opinions of Victor Reyes are. I mean, if the Tigers like him, it just seems like they're not doing him any favors by, kind of putting him through this bizarre situation where he's not actually playing any baseball games. So,
Yeah, it's like, do you like him enough to trade for his full rights or whatever, so you can put him down?
yeah,
Isn't that how it works? You can trade
yeah,
for the full rights.
yeah. They'd have to work out something with Arizona to kind of put that aside. And you would think Arizona, they already lost him, like that they wouldn't require a whole lot. And I don't know. Maybe the Tigers just don't really want to give up anything. And maybe that's the case, but it just seems like it'd be a lot better for him if they, could could find some young arm or something that no one really expects to do a whole lot and, you know, make some kind of a swap so they could send him down. And, you know, then the fans would be really happy because then we could call up, you know, Kristen Stewart or Mike Gerber or what have you, and we'd have that roster spot. But yeah, it just kind of feels like we keep bumping up against Victor Reyes' roster spot, and he's like, you know, the man who never speaks, the man who we never see.
Yeah, no, it's interesting because it's like it has to be, you're right, it has to be about, like, because it's not the opportunity cost of winning. Like, he's not the difference between winning and losing.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right that it is maybe the difference between seeing a player that fans are excited about and kind of waiting, shouting into the void for Kristen Stewart to get called up.
Yep. And just, yeah, I just worry about what this is doing to his confidence. But, you know, I'm kind of a worrywart about the Tigers in general. It's just my nature. So
fair enough. No, I'm team worry all the way.
Yeah.
Not necessarily about the Tigers, but about plenty of other stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. There's plenty to be worried about these days. No doubt.
That's right.
One thing we're worried about, or maybe not that worried about, is the Major League Draft. And it sounded, did you get down to Auburn to talk to Casey Mize?
That one I didn't go in person. That one we did over the phone.
Okay. You know, Casey Mize basically seems locked in 1-1. You know, this always happens. I've done this for a few years now, and there's always the last minute, oh, maybe the Tigers aren't in on Casey Mize, and, you know, there's an issue and behind the scenes, and they're thinking about this, and this, but by the end of the day, most of that stuff usually just turns out to be kind of chatter and, you know, maneuvering and all that sort of thing. So I'm still expecting it to be Casey Mize. What were your impressions of him talking to him?
Yeah, really thoughtful was the thing that I noticed the most, is the way that he talks about his arsenal and the way that he kind of looks back on certain life events that, I mean, the nature of my job oftentimes is to ask people about these, like, far, long time ago life events that I find interesting that they might not find interesting about their own life, you know?
Yeah, or to have to kind of be like the stranger asking about personal things, you know, that you've never met this person, and here we go.
100%, right. And so I was really struck by how willing to, like, engage on some of those things he was. Just really kind of thoughtful is the best way I can put it. And it was also interesting just because the whole reporting process to that, all I heard was like how intense this kid was.
Oh, yeah.
And so I'm thinking that I'm going to go into this interview and it's going to be one way, I guess. And, like, you know, kind of what you think of when you hear, like, really intense, competitive person. Like, I don't know. I guess I kind of had combative in my head.
Oh, yeah. Or maybe just like, you know, grumpy Miguel Cabrera, you know, type thing or something.
Sure.
Yeah.
But it was not combative at all. And I can see the intensity, like what is meant by that. But I think it came off just more in like a focus or whatever.
Yeah.
And I don't want to sound like I'm, like, you know, talking this kid up too much or whatever. Like, that's not that uncommon for someone to be really, like, reflective and thoughtful about themselves. But I was just really struck by that. Like, that interested me about him and about, you know, the person at this place of, like, really distinct. Like, I don't know if anything can compare. I've never experienced it, but, like, I don't know if anything can compare to, like, the month that you are likely to be, like, you know, likely the number one draft pick, but, like, almost for sure, like, a top five draft pick. Like, that's just such an interesting time in someone's life, you know?
Yeah. And people, like, watching every start, you know, like, yeah, their valuations, like, ticking up a little bit and then ticking down, and, you know, the fear of, like, you know, maybe hurting yourself or even just having some minor thing that, you know, the media could kind of, you know, misconstrue as a major issue because they don't, you know, necessarily know. Yeah. It's gotta be stressful. And he definitely seemed to handle it, you know, with a great deal of professionalism. You know, he definitely gives you that sort of that commanding sort of ace vibe in some of the interviews I've read from him. And I thought he was really forthright about, you know, the way people are kind of looking at his arsenal of pitches and kind of what a non-traditional sort of profile that is, being a guy who has, you know, a splitter is kind of a key out pitch, doesn't really have, you know, has like a good breaking ball, but it isn't really his showpiece, and the fastball is, you know, good, but not, you know, eye popping. So yeah, he seemed to have a really good head on his shoulders as far as, you know, understanding how he was being assessed by other people.
You're talking about Katie's article.
About Mize. Yeah. About,
yeah.
Yeah.
That was so good, wasn't it?
Yeah, it really was. Yep.
I was blown away by all the voices she got into that piece and about the splitter, but yeah.
So, yeah. She's great. She really is awesome. Yeah. Exactly. We've been big fans.
Yeah. And so, yeah, the split change is what he calls it, because I think he, like, that's exactly what you're talking about, right? It's like, he's conscious of the way people view it. And he's like, he wants them to know, like, this isn't your maybe typical splitter where you actually split it in half. Like, his hands aren't that big, so he can't necessarily do that anyway. So he throws it as a changeup, and he's got changeup back. That's the stuff I'm talking about, right? And I feel like he's so thoughtful about his own arsenal and how, like you said, how it gets viewed and how he sees it and how he sees it evolving. Like I think he's probably the type that will be kind of a little bit of a tinkerer and receptive to data, if not someone who's, I don't think he's gonna be someone who's seeking it out in mass, like in Trevor Bauer levels. But certainly someone who sounds like he'd be receptive to that kind of feedback.
Yeah, and definitely someone who seems like he does at least understand, kind of the process of using sort of like, modern technology and analysis to kind of improve himself. There was something in that piece about how they had kind of isolated some of the, like the tendonitis or arm issue that he'd had last year to his slider grip and action more than the splitter. So yeah, it sounds like he's pretty well versed, and that's something I've kind of gotten. We're kind of sabermetrics promoters over at Bless You Boys, and have kind of been pushing, for the Tigers, or at least just yelling and screaming about the Tigers kind of being behind the times. And you just kind of see that, especially at the big schools, like players are coming up, getting more and more used to having all this data at their disposal, and kind of being expected to process it and use it to get better. So yeah, it seemed like it was something that the Tigers were behind on for such a long time, and are, desperately kind of trying to catch up on. But you can kind of see it in a guy like Mize, who's already, kind of gone through the thing of like breaking down all of his stuff with slow motion cameras and everything like that.
Yeah, and like you said, they were looking for, I think it was a forearm strain is what he had talked about, was that like they were looking for why that happened, and they, like you said, they determined it was a slider thing. And yeah, just exactly what you're saying, like that shows that they're, willing to do kind of self-analysis that I think we talked about a little bit earlier too.
Yep, definitely. Yep. Yeah, it was, it kind of goes to that, Justin Verlander goes to Houston. I mean, obviously this has become a bit of an apocryphal, overblown thing, but yeah, going to Houston, and suddenly they fixed everything. They put all these fancy cameras on him and gave him all this data that he'd never had before, and now he's pitching the best baseball of his life, and he is pitching the best baseball of his life, which is just the damnedest thing.
It is, but like you said, I mean, he was a vote away from winning the Cy Young 2016. He was off to a plenty fine start, in 2017. Like it's not truly out of nowhere, but yeah, I get what you mean.
I mean, I think you can attribute some to, I mean, there's a better defense behind him, and I've kind of said enough about James McCann as a catcher, but the Astros seem a little bit sharper about, their catchers receiving and how to set up hitters and some of those things. Those are things where I think Bosio may have had a pretty good impact with the Tigers this year too. But yeah, I don't think Justin Verlander was magically transformed into a different pitcher when he went to Houston. He's just a badass in the second half, and you put him on the mound in a huge game and he's going to destroy people. So
Yeah,
just
I
who he
do
is.
wonder how much of it now is like that he's doing it in the first half, that like if that's like, okay, well now he's doing second half Verlander in the first half, so what's he gonna do in the second half kind
Yeah,
of
is he going
thing.
to run out of gas? Yeah.
Or is he gonna have a 0.4 ERA at the end of the year?
Yeah, I really wouldn't put anything past him. I mean, I am a Justin Verlander fanatic, so yeah, I've nothing would surprise me.
Right.
The last guy I wanted to kind of to touch on, who's sort of, in between like a prospect, who we're kind of looking for, like Joe Jimenez, a young player coming up, or Jacoby Jones. But Nico Goodrum is, really been extremely impressive at the plate, and kind of has a long, track record in the minor leagues of being a very successful hitter, and just kind of ran out of time in the Twins organization. Did you get a chance to talk to him about, kind of what that was like? And I know you wrote up a piece the other day about him returning to Minnesota. What is your impression of Mr. Goodrum so far? Because he's been raking and, screwing up on defense a little bit, but he's definitely been interesting.
Yeah, the talking to him was brief. It was about 3 minutes before the Monday game, and then after the game, when I decided I wanted to write about him, I figured I wanted to go to the Twins locker room and talk to like Buxton and some of those guys that came up with him. So I got more their perspective than his on like the Minnesota side. But no, I mean that's sort of was the crux of the piece, was like this guy's hitting now, and that's good for him, for someone who didn't, like you said, did not get a ton of like kind of time to do that in the Twins organization, at least at the big league level. So, but soon, like some players are gonna get back from injury. He's playing third right now with Candelario out. Like, what's going to happen to the hitting? Like, can he do? He had an 8-game hit streak not long ago. I think he had like 3 multi-hit games in a row. Can he do those things when there's a day or two between starts? Like, if he can, that's a piece. Like, that's a piece. It's interesting. Like, his defense is not necessarily good enough to be a super utility guy in the sense that at least I was raised to think of a super utility guy. But like you'll take a bat on the bench any day of the week, right? Like a guy who hits 270 with power, like or 250 with power even, like that's a piece, right? I mean,
And and it's interesting because I've got his Fangraphs page up, and I'm looking at just simply, just like his WRC plus, through his years with the Twins. I see 107 in Double A, 149 at High A, 133, in 200 plate appearances in 2016 at Double A. So there is a track record there. And for me, I'm probably rushing this. I can't help it, but I look at Dixon Machado. Obviously Jose Iglesias is going to be gone sometime this year or at the end of the year. And the big theme for me of the rebuild now that they've kind of got a stockpile of pitching built up in the minor leagues, but what they don't have, they've got catching, they've got some outfielders, but what they don't have is the middle infielders kind of the future. And it really, I kind of don't feel like Dixon Machado is that guy. And I don't know if Dowell Lugo is that guy. So I keep looking at Nico Goodrum thinking, like, should we maybe just be playing this guy every day?
Interesting. I don't know. I mean, it's and Dixon's defense has had a couple of moments that I think I can understand where you're coming from with that because he was billed as like a defensive dude and has had a couple of moments there. I think I can understand
And he is
why
playing out
you.
of position, obviously, so.
Right. I don't know. I mean, I still think that. Mean, first of all, Machado at the beginning of the year, this was the opposite. You know, Machado was like, oh wow, this is meaningful stuff at the bat that can balance it out, but he has definitely kind of come back down to earth recently. But I don't know. I mean, it kind of would come down to like if you're willing to sacrifice that much defense in the middle infield. Like, not to say Goodrum can't play middle infield. I think he could be a reasonably competent second baseman with enough time. But that's interesting. I don't know. I hadn't really given that too much consideration.
Yeah, I'm just curious kind of what the Tigers are thinking of doing with him, because like you said, he seems like a pretty useful guy to have on the bench, and is athletic enough to kind of play everywhere, just sort of doesn't quite have the maybe the instincts, or maybe there's the occasional mental mistake. But I look at Dixon Machado, and I'm going to trust that his defense is going to somewhat approximate Jose Iglesias's level at shortstop, or at least in the ballpark. It's just a question of whether or not he can produce enough, because we look at the Astros and the Yankees, and the big teams all have middle infields that can hit for power as well as average and on base percentage. So yeah, that seems to be like the hole in the rebuild right now that I don't really see in the minor leagues really having a lot of help coming either. So
Do you see Paredes as a middle infielder?
I'm sorry, who?
Isaac Paredes.
Oh, I'm boy, maybe. But I have to kind of trust the judgment of a lot of the scouts I've talked to are just like, there's just going to be really tough for him to stay there and keep the weight off and not, and have the mobility to kind of move side to side at shortstop. Like he's got the hands, he's got the arm to play third base if they wanted him to. But yeah, it just doesn't seem like he's quite got the quickness to be a middle infielder playing around the bag all the time. And
Yeah.
it,
No, I mean that because that to me is like the key to that question. It's like if you see Paredes, I don't know, that's a
I don't
pronunciation
know.
one I'm not
I'm going
quite
to say
certain on.
I'll say Paredes.
Yeah, Paredes. If you see him as a starting middle infielder, then like you're looking for like kind of one piece because I think most people see him as being a big part of the rebuild. But if you see him as a third baseman or a first baseman or whatever, like then yeah, then it's a huge hole. But I think where I like come down on it in either way is like I think that like in terms of progress on like in the rebuild, like I think people are looking like a little too much at what's there now as what like this is what there's to work with. Like you got a couple potentially big trades coming this year and a big draft, and if they go pitcher, then yeah, maybe that's not the answer to that. But I will say that I think like the answers to a few of the rebuild questions have to be that the answer isn't in the system yet. You know, like you got outfielders coming, but you know, you sure wouldn't say no to another one. You got pitchers there, but you sure wouldn't say no to a guy if you knew he was going to be a one or a two starter. So I mean, that's kind of where I come down on a lot of rebuild questions is like it's possible that the answer to the middle infield it just patently is not in the system there. Like it's probably, you know, if it's not Machado and it's not Goodrum and it's not Paredes, like it's probably not. It's probably still to be drafted or traded for, you know.
And I, you know, that's, you know, obviously there, you know, there's a lot of moving parts, and you know, it's just the nature of me and probably every fan to kind of want to speed things up. But I also, you know, you look at, you know, can you trade, you know, a Michael Fulmer and get, you know, a really high-end middle infield prospect? And you know, the Yankees weren't willing to deal Gleyber Torres for him. It sounds, you know, at least that's kind of the read on what negotiations sounded like this offseason. So yeah, you do wonder if the Tigers can pull someone like that in trade. But we also don't know what Chris Ilitch's plans as far as, you know, his willingness to spend are. You know, I mean, the Tigers could very easily go and, I don't know, sign Manny Machado, and then, you know, like, just wait for the pitching to show up. And I don't know, maybe we're in business there. But yeah, it's definitely that's definitely like the linchpin of the whole rebuild to me is going to be how they address, yeah, that middle infield.
Especially when all of like the powerhouses in the league now, like you're right, like have that. Like you look at Cleveland and like, you know, Jose Ramirez is playing third right now, but it's not hard to imagine a world where he is the second baseman like next year. And you'd have him and Lindor, like two of the maybe top 10 players in the AL in the middle infield on the same team. The Yankees, you know, you could have Didi Gregorius and Gleyber Torres. The Red Sox, you got Bogarts there. I mean, there are, yeah, you're absolutely right.
I guess the Red Sox are maybe the exception, because obviously Pedroia is not the player he used to be and is just coming back. But yeah, you go to the Astros with Correa and Altuve, and yeah,
Yeah,
there's
Correa,
definitely some
Altuve, right? That's the
monsters.
best one. I don't even know how I didn't say that.
Well, you know, I don't know. We'll see. I'm a big fan of Lindor and Ramirez too. Those guys can rake. So yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, no, Ramirez is so underrated. I mean, it's getting corrected now. Like he's finally been so good for so long that people aren't ignoring it. But yeah, he's crazy good.
Yeah, for sure. All right, Max. Well, yeah, I really appreciate you coming on the podcast, man. It's been great to talk to you, and we were, you know, we've really been fans of your work, and you know, trying to promote the Athletic in general, because I just think, you know, like, the quality of journalism that's being produced out there is worth paying for. And the more, you know, people kind of go out there and you know, you kind of get what you pay for in life, you know, more often than not. And you know, like, if people are willing to subscribe, it's not particularly expensive. And man, the major league coverage has just been incredible. You know, I don't even really follow other sports, and I wasn't sure, you know, like, do I need this much more coverage of the Tigers? But what's turned out is that, like, it just seems like every athletic department, you know, across, you know, major leagues has really hired some great people, and obviously the big boys like Ken Rosenthal, and it's been well worth it. So stoked for you guys, and yeah, we're gonna keep boosting you. So
Thanks for saying that, man. No, I can't tell you how much I appreciate it. And you guys have been doing killer work for a long time. Like you guys have consistently been a really, really good source on the Tigers to read and just stay, you know, in the just conversationally like competent in with like people that I knew when I was in college or whatever. Like I feel like that was a huge place that like you had to be reading what you guys were doing over there to know what everyone was going to be talking about with that. So you guys are doing awesome stuff.
Thank you. Yep. Thank you very much. Yep. We're just, yeah, you know, like, our niche is kind of like, yeah, just trying to keep that, you know, that community of Tiger fans, and keep bringing up the topics and trying to dig deep into things. So yeah,
No,
we'll keep doing
absolutely.
our thing.
You're doing great. I mean, you guys are awesome stuff out there.
Thanks, man. Thanks very much. All right. Well, yeah, hopefully we can have you on later this season, but I'll let you go for now.
Anytime, man. No, thank you so much.
Yep. Have a good night, Max.
You too.
Bye-bye.